You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
My guest today on the podcast is Jill Stoddard, who is the founder and director of the Center for Stress and Anxiety Management, a multi-site outpatient psychotherapy clinic specializing in acceptance and commitment therapy, otherwise known as ACT, and cognitive and behavioral therapy for anxiety and related issues. She's an award-winning teacher and recognized ACT trainer. She has co-authored articles and books in the ACT, CBT, anxiety, trauma, and pain categories. And her latest book is called Imposter No More, Overcome Self-Doubt and Imposterism to Cultivate a Successful Career. Enjoy the pod.
Another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Jill Stoddard, welcome to the show.
Hi, Kelly. Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So some years back, I gave a TEDx talk, and I presented the idea that 99% of the people in the world think they are frauds, myself included. We think we're bad friends, bad parents, bad colleagues, bad spouses. And then I suggested that the 1% that don't think that are probably the most dangerous people on the planet. I have no science to back up this claim, and that point was actually brought home to me after the talk when I overheard a couple arguing in the lobby. I heard the husband distinctly say, "He just made up that 99% thing. He's an improv guy, not a scientist." Now, you have degrees next to your name. I'm not really that far off, right?
You are not that far off. So what the science says is up to 70% of people feel like frauds. But okay. I think where you're actually probably right about the 99% were all those other things you said. So this, like, I'm not good enough story,
right,
seems to actually be nearly universal for all humans. And then, yes, there's this tiny percentage of people who maybe are narcissists or sociopaths. I mean, I don't have science to back that up, but that's a hypothesis that probably that small portion of people that don't have any form of an inner critic are those types of people and are dangerous. Yes, I would agree with you on that.
And there's a term for many of those people, and it's called the Dunning-Kruger effect, right?
Yep.
Can you explain to our audience? I mean, they've heard me reference it before, but I haven't done it in a while.
Yes. So the Dunning-Kruger effect is basically, it's a cognitive bias where there's a failure in self-awareness, where people who have limited knowledge or competence or skills wrongly overestimate their knowledge or competence or skills in a given area. And then because they lack the competence, they lack the ability to recognize their deficiencies. Right. So like they don't question their legitimacy. But, you know, the easy way to think of it is like they're not smart enough to know they're not smart.
That is a perfect way to describe
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And you are probably describing a good 75% of my bosses over time that I've had.
Oh, that's tough. That's tough.
Yeah. But it tends to be true. I mean, again, and I'm talking about a lot of cisgendered white men. And I know that there's some research that sort of backs us up too, in terms of if you we talk about being growing up on third base or whatever, but if you grow up and you have these things and you go to good schools and you just assume, of course, it's because, you know, of your excellence, and you never assume that there might be some sort of systemic thing going on that allowed you to walk in to a place that another person simply can't get by the barriers.
Yeah, totally. I tell the story in the book about telling my dad, who's a straight, cis, white male, all the things, that I was giving a talk on imposter syndrome. And he was like, huh, what's that? And I figured once I explained it to him, he would recognize the concept, even if he didn't know what it was called. And so I explained it to him and he was just dumbfounded. And, you know, he was an entrepreneur who started and sold companies, but it never occurred to him that that it wasn't his place to do that. And that's not his fault, right? Like we all just sort of swim in the cultural waters that we swim in. And, you know, if you're part of the majority groups, you don't really get messages that you don't belong at all the tables. But if you're female or transgendered or gay or Black or, you know, any person of color, an immigrant, a disabled person, there are overt and covert messages across your lifetime that maybe you don't belong in certain spaces. And so it stands to reason that you would then develop these kinds of ideas like, I'm a fraud, I don't belong here, I'm going to be outed at any moment. The research on this is unfortunately very limited. So this is still sort of a hypothesis. I hope people will take up this mantle and actually do some good science to research this. But it seems to be a pretty reasonable hypothesis.
That's right. So people often ask me like, okay, so what are you reading right now? Who are you interviewing? And I told them you, and I would say this book is about imposter syndrome. However, I am, after reading this book, going to try to not use the word syndrome. So tell us why that particular moniker might be problematic.
I love it. And I hope this can be like a whole cultural rebranding. Well, first of all, if 70% of us have it, it can't be a syndrome because it's just normal.
Yeah.
Right? Like if this is a nearly universal human experience, then it's not some like disordered psyche. So that's kind of number one. You know, the other, and I think the history of this is fascinating. When Pauline Clance and Suzanne Imes first identified this phenomenon, they called it the imposter phenomenon, but they thought that it only appeared in high achieving women. And so lo and behold, shortly after something that appeared among high achieving women was called a phenomenon, our culture rebranded it to a syndrome, right? Wow. They made this like, oh, women don't have confidence, they must have a syndrome. And I don't think that that's a coincidence, right? And so if the hypothesis is accurate that this may develop out of experiences with discrimination or oppression, then that is another reason that it should not be called a syndrome, right? This is not about a disordered psyche. This is a normal human reaction, especially for people who have had experiences of being marginalized.
Right, right, right. So your personal imposterism story, I'll use that term, begins when you applied to a PhD program at BU. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it's getting easier for me to tell. I'll admit the first time I told it, it gave me so much anxiety because I think everyone is going to think this is true and they're all going to know I didn't belong in this situation. So I had a mentor in my master's program say, now, listen, you're going to go off to graduate school to your PhD program and you're going to think, I don't belong here. Everybody's better than me. And my eyes just got wide and I went, oh my God, how does he know that? Is he like reading my mind? This had already happened to me. And he never gave this experience a name, but it was the first time that I realized this is like a thing maybe other people experience. And where it came from for me in that context is I applied to this very competitive program that I never thought I'd get into in a billion years. And I was living in San Diego at the time, and it was in Boston, which is home for me. And I didn't tell my parents because I didn't want any pressure to come back home. And then the guilt ate away at me. And I finally confessed to my dad that I was applying to this program at Boston University to work with a guy named David Barlow. And my dad went, Dave Barlow? The clinical psychologist? And I was like, wait, what? Like, he's a businessman. He doesn't know anything about psychology or mental health. But it turns out they had played golf together at the same golf club. So the next time he saw Dr. Barlow, he said, oh, hey, my kid is applying to your program. Fast forward a few months, I got in. And that was in the year 2000, so 23 years ago. And to this day, despite racking up many achievements in the last two decades, I still feel really insecure that I did not deserve a spot in such a, felt like such a mediocre applicant. I don't know how I got that spot. It must just be because Dave played golf with my dad, which of course is not giving David Barlow very much credit, think like it's sort of offensive toward him that he's just going to give away one of his 12 slots to somebody who's not going to go make him proud out in the real world, right?
That's right.
And rationally, of course, I get that. But emotionally, I still hold this like deep insecurity that that is the only reason I got into that program.
And this is in many ways because the power of stories, right? So we are human beings. We're storytelling machines. We love stories, but we also use stories to explain ourselves. And the stories that we tell ourselves, they can be wonderful. They can be part of a therapeutic process. They can be about dealing with trauma, all that. And they can also screw us up. And I think that's what you're kind of getting at. This is the, you say, quote in the book, unfortunately, old self stories are pretty hardwired and humans aren't manufactured with a delete button. Oh, if we only had a delete button, right?
Oh, if only. Like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Yeah.
Zap it right out of there. Yeah, no, it's so true. And you know, I think importantly, these stories are meant to protect us and keep us safe, right? When your mind is saying you're not good enough or you're a fraud or whatever it may be, it's really in an effort to protect you from humiliation or failure or rejection. You know, we humans are social beings. And since the dawn of humanity, there is an advantage to, you know, we now know through loads of research that like the number one factor that predicts overall physical and mental health and well-being is relationships. So much of our mind is trying to protect us from anything that threatens our connection with other human beings. And so, you know, if I'm outed as a fraud, if I'm incompetent, if I'm inadequate, then if people discover that, they're going to reject and abandon me and I'll be alone. And so, you know, these stories are designed to protect us. They just unfortunately don't do a very good job and also get in the way of us really being able to thrive and live the lives we want to live.
I think another thing that was interesting reading this book, and this has come up a lot in the last few years, is a realization that words are so important and that our sometimes our associations with certain words lead to assumptions that can be really wrong. And you talk about this with the idea of positive and negative reinforcement learning, generally speaking. And I was guilty of this, right? When I immediately assigned a value to those two things when they are valueless in the same way we bias, like people assume, well, bias is just bad. You're like, well, that's not really the case. Or stress. Mm-hmm. That's not really the case. So talk to us about positive and negative reinforcement and what we get wrong about that.
Well, what you often hear people say is, oh, that's an example of negative reinforcement. So I think the example that most commonly comes up is, let's say you see a kid having a tantrum in the store because he wants a toy. And the mother is yelling at the kid, and that actually makes them scream more. Mm-hmm. You know, when people think you're saying negative reinforcement, so people will assume that, like, if a person is yelling at their kid, this is an example of negative reinforcement because the act of yelling is something that's negative or aversive.
Yep.
But really, the word negative just means to take something away. So mm-hmm. positive reinforcement, you're adding something. Negative reinforcement, you're taking something away. And reinforcement just means whatever that thing is you're doing, the consequence increases the likelihood that a behavior will happen again.
Yeah. So that could be ultimately a good thing or a bad thing, depending on a variety of contexts.
It depends on your target, the target behavior that you want. Like if you want more of a behavior or you want less of a behavior. And you know, anything could be a positive or negative reinforcer or punisher. You know, what's reinforcing for me might be punishing for you and vice versa.
Right.
Can't assume, you know, if I yell at my daughter, she might decrease her behavior. If I yell at my son, he might increase his behavior. So what's a punisher for her is a reinforcer for him. So it's all very context specific.
When I talk about improvisation, whether I'm giving a keynote or I'm on a podcast or whatever, I'm often using phrases that are well-worn at Second City that we use in the classroom. Things like, you've got to learn to play the scene you're in, not the scene you want to be in. We have to replace blame with curiosity. We have to be fiercely in the moment. We've got to make our partner look good. And it strikes me that many of those terms could be underneath this bucket that you refer to as psychological flexibility.
Yeah, that's exactly the thought I had as you were saying that. I'm like, oh, that's so ACT consistent. That's so psychological flexibility.
Well, and talk about ACT and talk about psychological flexibility.
So that, so psychological flexibility is the goal of ACT, which is acceptance and commitment therapy. And so psychological flexibility, it's really simple. It's not an easy thing to do, but it is a simple concept, which is just our ability to be in this present moment, because it's the only one that we actually have.
Yep.
With all of our thoughts, feelings, physiological sensations, urges, fully and without defense. Like, we notice they're there, we allow them to be there without doing anything to control them in any way. And then we make conscious, deliberate choices about what we're going to do or not do, based on our values. And values are just like what you want to stand for, what you want to be about in the world, your actions and the qualities of actions that represent the me that you most deeply want to be. So I think everything you just said is really in line with that.
And because you can't fight it, right? It will exist. I was thinking about this in the sense of, I've never done martial arts, but what I understand is that is it's almost purely defensive in its sense of like, no, we know where the blow is coming and we kind of go with it and take it in. Mm-hmm. Because, and you know, and certainly ideas in Buddhism are, you know, sort of flow in here as well. But it's because like, there's no way to eliminate the negative thoughts, period, right?
100% correct. And there are some, you know, in traditional cognitive behavioral therapy, people are taught to sort of replace unhelpful thoughts with more helpful thoughts. And in some cases, that can work, right? If I'm sitting in traffic and I'm thinking, oh, this sucks and I'm going to be late and don't these stupid people have jobs? Why is everyone on the road? You know, I can catch that and go, okay, getting upset about this is not going to get you anywhere faster. It's not the end of the world. It's just traffic. You'll get there when you get there. And that will actually make me feel a little bit better. But typically when we try to do the exact same thing to these deeper, like, I am inadequate, I am not good enough, those kinds of thoughts, it just backfires. You know, when I told you that I thought I only got into graduate school because my dad knew the director, you could have sat here and read off my whole resume and told me like all the reasons that I did get in on my own merit and all the amazing things I've done since then. And my brain will just go, well, yeah, but, and I can just give you just as much data to discount everything you said. And that's just what brains do.
Mm-hmm.
So we tend to get, we end up giving the thoughts more power when we try so hard to change the content of them. And what psychological flexibility and ACT are about are changing our relationship to those experiences instead, like kind of letting go of the battle against them and just letting what is already there anyway to just be there and not letting it affect your behavior and your choices.
I was talking to Michael Gervais yesterday. So he's coming on the podcast. He has his own podcast. He is a sports psychologist and famously worked with the Seattle football team when they won the Super Bowl. And his book is about fear of other people's opinions. So not dissimilar from what we're talking about here. And, you know, I kept stressing one of the powerful aspects of improvisational training is that it's embodied. And that certainly, you know, when I first entered this work, I was all about brain, both for myself and the things I was seeing. And then over time, just realized more and more and more, the body is kind of showing up first. It's not to say the brain. And you say in the book, quote, our minds and bodies can be obnoxiously compelling.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you're referring to, which is, wow, this is like, there's a bunch going on here and it ain't just all up in the noggin.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And when you said that it's about being embodied, I got literal chills on my body. So that's sort of like a nice parallel process. And I call that my body barometer. It's usually telling me, you know, that there's something important that has just entered into this space. You know, the first time I ever noticed it was the first time I ever sat with a client and did clinical work. And I just had chills. And I knew in that moment, like, this is my calling. This is really what I'm meant to do. And that body barometer hasn't steered me wrong since. And I think that's an example of that. And we often ignore those things, or if they're uncomfortable, then we do our best to escape or avoid them. And, you know, that can really come at a cost. It can keep us stuck. It can keep us, you know, from like, it just kind of restricts the repertoire of opportunities that we have if we're so focused on not experiencing the internal experiences that are uncomfortable for us.
You also write in the book, quote, "We don't escape being human without a generous helping of pain, but sometimes we get to choose how much we suffer," end quote. Talk about that. How do we choose how much we suffer?
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier that there are some elements in this book that are similar to Buddhism, and that is spot on. And there is a lot of ACT that is, ACT was influenced by a number of different traditions. And one of those is Buddhism and other, you know, old ancient Eastern traditions. And so in Buddhism, they say pain times resistance equals suffering. Mm. And pain is just part of being human. I mean, we come out of the womb screaming, literally, our very first experience in this world. And if we're not, it actually means something's terribly wrong. Mm-hmm. And so you don't get to be a human being in this life and not do pain. It's just part of the deal. But resistance is optional, right? And so if we have pain and we have resistance, we have a lot of suffering. But if we have pain without resistance, then we just have pain.
Interesting. My wife has a book coming out next year, and it's called Funnier, which is about her comedy theory. And part of her comedy theory is that all comedy is three elements. And if you look at it like a mixing board, you have recognition, some level of kind of truth, you have pain, and you have distance. And it's with regard to those three elements are always there for there to be comedy. And the pain and distance thing is really in terms of like, you can dial up the pain if you've got more distance, and then you have to reduce that distance when you have pain. And I think about this because while we talked about improvisation, comedy is another element of truth telling. And I think that has always been a case of like, we need another lens by which to see the things that are going on in the world that might be, if we just sort of deal with them baldly, too painful. So when we have this sort of comedy thing, right? But what we're talking about, pretty serious. The stuff we're laughing at is usually pretty serious.
Yeah. Well, what this makes me think of, so because I'm thinking, oh, I guess you could see that as an example of resistance, or what we call it in ACT is experiential avoidance, which is anything mm-hmm. that you do or don't do to try to change your internal experience. And typically mm-hmm. that means trying to push away discomfort that we don't like, or trying to grab on to feelings that we do want to have. And so, you know, making something serious into something more funny, you could certainly see as an example of experiential avoidance, but experiential avoidance is only problematic if it has a cost. And I think this is a brilliant example of something that doesn't have a cost.
That's right.
And that's when we're talking about resistance, that's what we're talking about, experiential avoidance. And so the idea is like, your pain is not your problem. It's all the things you're doing because you're unwilling to have the pain that are keeping you stuck.
Yeah. Right?
So like, if I felt very anxious about coming on to talk to you and your audience today, and I didn't like that feeling of anxiety, the best way to get rid of it is to cancel on you.
Yes.
And then I would get immediate relief, but I would have much more suffering because I've been looking forward to this conversation. It feels important. It's my mission to try to share these concepts with as many people as I possibly can. I want to be somebody who is courageous and brave. It's important to me to connect with people, to be vulnerable. So if I had turned that down, I would get relief, but I'd be sacrificing all of these important values, this me I want to be. And that's where the suffering comes in. But if you have avoidance that's like, it's raining out and I put up an umbrella, that's technically avoidance, but there's no cost. And it might even make it more likely that I'm going to, you know, go do the things I want to do because now I'm outside, but I'm still nice and dry.
Yeah.
And I think comedy is a good example.
Yeah. And I think another way to look at it is comedy is a reframe. Mm. You know, it's a simple reframe of a particular, and usually it's a problem. Right. There's an equation of like, you know, you think you're doing 1 + 1 = 2. And we're kind of showing you that maybe 1 + 1 might = 3. And it's incongruent in that sense, which is also uneasy. But as a comedian are really playing with the audience in terms of that, because if you just do the hard hitting stuff the whole time, you're going to lose them. So you've got to figure, I think it's George Carlin who's this wonderful phrase of, I want to take people up to the line and I want to have them cross that line with me and be glad they came. And people always forget the be glad they came. A lot of people are like, oh, I want to cross the line. It's like, yeah, that's fine. But you got to make them be glad they came. It's not just crossing a line. Right. And I think that's the difference between what I would call wise comedy and maybe other people call comedy. And you talk about Marsha Linehan with this term wise mind, which made me think about this. Can you talk about what that is?
Yeah. So wise mind is what Marsha Linehan talks about. She's a psychologist who is the developer of a therapy called dialectical behavior therapy, or DBT. Pretty famously talked about by Lady Gaga. So people may have heard of it from her a couple of years ago. So what Marsha talks about is that we have these different states of mind. And one is emotion mind, which is where we have feelings and where our creativity comes from, probably where some comedy comes from.
Sure.
And then we have rational mind or reasonable mind. And this is like facts and figures. And what always pops in my head is, you know, balancing your checkbook. And then I realize that makes me sound really old and I need a much more modern example than balancing your checkbook. But, you know, this is like data and pros and cons and whatnot. And so if you're only in rational mind, that's going to be problematic. Likewise, if you're only in emotion mind, that's going to be problematic. And if you picture a Venn diagram, wise mind is where these two things overlap. And it's like this kind of grounded sense of knowing, maybe a gut feeling, maybe intuition, you know, but it's that thing that sort of transcends words. That's like, you just sort of know or feel that something is right because you've done both of these things. And I could see comedy, you have to have the facts and the figures and the logic, but also the creativity and the feeling. And when those two things interact is when you probably get good comedy.
My friend Jen Ellison kind of refers to this in her Venn diagram around comedy as the difference between thin jokes and thick jokes. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the thin jokes are like fart jokes, not really interesting to her, but the thick jokes are the one that are really sort of playing with all that soil. I didn't expect to talk about comedy with you, but it is, but actually it shouldn't be surprising. I mean, like, I've been in therapy for a while and we laugh a lot. And I think it is so necessary. And you talk about this in the book when you talk about play. And the quote is, quote, getting playful with our thinking is like kryptonite to the inner imposter. And I love that because really we don't pay enough attention to play, especially as adults. Somehow it's equated with frivolity. Somehow it's equated with wasting time, when in fact, most of all our jobs in the world of AI are going to need to center around what human beings are good at, and that are all things that relate to our ability to be playful problem solvers, playful storytellers, all the things that are play-centered.
The computers can't do. Oh, yeah.
They can't
that's
do
interesting.
It.
I've never thought of that before.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you had Mike Rucker on as a guest. Did you have him on? He wrote a book called The Fun Habit.
No,
have had a lot of guests overlap on our podcast. I wasn't sure if he was one of them.
No, I had another guest on who talked about the fun as a concept. But yeah, I'm sure a similar conversation, which is like this stuff is really important, and yet
there's science behind that.
There is science behind it.
Right? Yeah, yeah. It's not just like, oh, I think we should do more of this. There is science behind the importance of us maintaining play and creativity and fun.
How do you do that so you're an adult, you're with adult responsibilities, and you recognize the play's fun. Are there ways that you incorporate that into your world?
Like in therapy with my clients, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so one of the ways we build psychological flexibility is through building willingness or acceptance. That's what the acceptance part of acceptance and commitment therapy means. And what that is it's changing your relationship to your emotions, physical sensations, urges, right? So you're opening up and making space for discomfort. And so I love to do this in really playful kinds of ways. And so my favorite way, I even have it right here in my drawer. I can pull them out and show you, even though we're not on video. But look, see, do you know these Bean Boozled jelly beans?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I'll play Bean Boozled with my clients where you spin a spinner. And, you know, I have them order, we do all telehealth. So they order theirs online and we're on the computer with each other and we all have our jelly beans. And, you know, you spin the spinner and it says you have to eat the pink speckled jelly bean, but you don't know if it's going to be pomegranate or old dirty bandage. And so we eat these together, but we do it as a mindful willingness exercise. And so it sort of has this twofold, you know, they're learning a therapeutic skill, but we're also doing it in a way that like isn't so serious, you know? And believe me, there is a lot of laughter when when we do things like this. Sometimes I'm not wearing my glasses today. Otherwise you and I could do this, but you know, I'll have us turn our glasses upside down.
Yeah.
And then you can practice willingness toward how it feels funny on your face, how you can't see because the prescription is not the right way, how maybe you're feeling a little embarrassed that the other person sees you looking so silly. And so it has this like dual purpose again of like, it's playful and fun, but it's also a way of building psychological flexibility and learning a therapeutic skill that you can then apply in other areas of your life outside of therapy.
Jill, I don't recall when we spoke last, did we talk about the origin story of Second City and Viola Spolin, the social worker who started all this stuff?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. So Second
although
City,
it sounds familiar, you might have written about it in your book because I read Yes And.
Yeah,
so I think it might have been in there, but I don't think you and I talked about it. Remind me though.
Yeah. So all these exercises and games that we taught to the founders and that we taught to Stephen Colbert and Tina Fey, and you know, this is still part of the curriculum and the pedagogy of Second City, were essentially, most of them were created by a social worker in the 20s and 30s by the name of Viola Spolin, whose job was to better assimilate immigrant children and kids from the, you know, projects of Chicago,
yeah,
to collaborate and play. And this sort of idea of sort of gamifying social and emotional skills and self-regulation and all that seemed odd at a certain point, and it no longer seems odd to me. It seems like dead on.
Yes, totally. Everybody's finally caught on and has been doing a lot more of that.
Yeah. And I think it also goes back to the embodied aspect, because these games require you to be present in a room with other people, moving in a room with other people. And I had this observation, and I want to see if I've tested out a few people, and most people are, I'm finding more and more that people do not know how to walk out in the world with other people. You know what I'm talking about?
Like literally walk?
Literally be in a space with other people and recognize how to put their bodies there. I'm getting bumped into, I'm having people block me. I'm being like, dude, like what is happening here? Or even driving and having people like cut, like what? And it's not just obnoxious behavior of trying to cut in. It's like just they don't know.
Not paying. Well, maybe it's because our attention has been so hijacked by all things
technology.
Well, that's
technology. One thing, right?
I think it's affecting everybody's executive function in odd ways that we're maybe not realizing.
And 2 years not being in crowds of more than a couple people.
Right. Yeah. We don't know how to be with large groups of people. And yeah, I think that is true. But I love this idea of doing anything that can be embodied. You know, one of the ways I like to teach the benefits of present moment awareness is I don't do this as much now that I'm on telehealth, but when I was in person, because I've moved to Boston and I still do therapy in California, which is why I'm online. I would bring a blown up balloon and have my adult, I only see adults, have my adult patients play the keep the balloon off the ground game.
Yep.
And then tell them to try to worry about something. You know, so if there's somebody who's like worrying about paying their bills, I'll be like, okay, keep the balloon off the ground and worry about paying your bills. And you can't do it.
Can't do it.
Right? Because you can only be in one time at a time, right?
Yep.
Past, present, or future. You can't be in the present and in the future at the same time. And that's so much more effective than saying that with words. And actually a huge part of acceptance and commitment therapy is experiential learning and experiential practice. And it's just so much more salient and memorable.
That's fascinating. Of course. I mean, and we do so many exercises with like brightly colored balls that we do, which are all about navigating complexity and navigating ambiguity and communication and that sort of thing. But even more reductive is the simple idea you have. And I think about this because I often talk about the fact that you can't be creative if you're in judgment of self or others. And so part of this also, I think that worry element is also playing around with this sort of self-judgment stuff that like, oh, I'm lesser than because of.
Yeah, absolutely. Hmm.
That's fascinating. Okay.
Fun. And fun.
No, absolutely fun. We always ask our guest if they can end the podcast with a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
I absolutely have one for you. So I have tried to get up on water skis almost every single summer since I was a little girl, probably since I was 8. I have never even come close to getting up for one single second.
Okay.
This year I turned 50. And when I went snow, I hadn't snow skied in about 25 years, and I got back on snow skis in 2019, and I only fell once, but the one time I fell, I re-injured an already injured shoulder. Mm-hmm. Now fast forward 4 more years, and I'm thinking about getting up on water skis, and I'm 50, and I'm thinking, I'm going to rip my arm straight out of my shoulder if I do this. Like, this is a terrible idea. Like, be smart. Don't be a hero. So normally this is something I absolutely would have said no to.
Mm-hmm.
But then I thought, but like, what if? Like, what if the very first time I ever get up on water skis is the year I turned 50? Like, how epic would that be? And even if I don't get up, at least I'm modeling perseverance to my kids, because I keep trying, even though I have failed more times than you could possibly count over 40 years. And so I tried and I fell, and my falls are awesome. Like, I fall straight back. It's hilarious on video. Nobody understands what's happening. And then I got up for 6 seconds, and it was like one of the best moments of my entire life. And then I tried again, and I did it. I did a whole loop around this little area of the lake, 2.5 minutes, and I didn't even fall. I ended up letting go because I was so tired. It is a lot harder than it looks. It's hard to get up, but it is also hard to stay up once you're up there. And so that was a yes and. I thought, like, ooh, probably I shouldn't. And then I thought, but what if?
Yeah.
And
I mean, that's
like one of that's the five moments of my life.
Sure. It's our relationship with failure, right? We do so much to avoid it. And in our work, like, the beginning improv classes are almost all related to getting you comfortable with being uncomfortable. Yeah. And that means failing aggressively in front of other people.
Yeah.
Over and over. Because then once you've done it a bunch of times, like, this is no problem.
I can handle it.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not that bad.
And then you can take that outside that classroom. You can take that to every other thing that you do, because we are all failing constantly.
Constantly.
And I think, just culturally speaking, right? That is, we just get it drummed into us that you can't. And it's just, it's not like why we don't, it's not like this science is new around us, right?
Yeah.
The scientific method is literally failure, 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 failure.
Yep.
You learn by failing, not by succeeding.
Totally.
Yeah. And then you do it yourself.
The payoff is so much better. If all you ever do is succeed, you don't ever like get the zhuzh.
Yeah.
Right.
That's
or
right.
If I had tried getting up on skis 5 times and got up my 6th, like, woo, yay. But to fail for 40 years and then to be able to do it, like, I will never forget this. And my whole family was in the boat, and we have it all on video, and they were screaming their faces off, which was like the other best part of it. And I'm getting goosebumps again. For days after that, my 9-year-old son kept going, "Mommy, you did it. Can you believe it? You did it." And it motivated him to keep trying, because he just started trying and he hasn't quite been able to get up yet. So we're going back up there this weekend. I said, "Are you going to try to get up on skis again?" He's like,
Yep. That's great. The book is called Imposter No More: Overcome Self-Doubt and Imposterism to Cultivate a Successful Career. Jill Stoddard, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thanks so much for having me, Kelly. It was great to talk to you again.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. We'll be right back.
feet.
Adulthood, no one survives.